This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. The U.S. territory, Puerto Rico, started its cleanup from Hurricane Fiona earlier this week on the five-year anniversary of when Hurricane Maria ripped through the island. It has been so much, and we're feeling it here in Massachusetts, where roughly 340,000 of our friends and neighbors identify as Puerto Rican. Those are 2019 numbers. So how is our community here? How is the community there? And what can we do? We'll begin with Pedro Reyna Perez, director of the Harvard Puerto Rico Winter Institute. Professor, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So how are you? Do you have close family and friends in Puerto Rico? How are they?
I'm fine. I happen to be in San Juan. And if you were here in the greater metropolitan area, you could barely tell that a hurricane went by because there's only limited damage, not as much as Maria. But as you get away from the greater metropolitan area where 2 million people live, and you go to other parts of the island, the devastation is clear. Most of the damage has been done by floods. It rained heavily until yesterday. And as a result, many rivers overflowed. And there is, you know, extensive flooding throughout the island.
I know you teach in Puerto Rico. Were you in Puerto Rico in 2017 when Hurricane Maria hit?
No, I was able to leave San Juan exactly the day before Maria struck. I was in Boston, and I was unable to return to the island for almost 3 weeks. So I lived that experience, which was excruciating, because I could tell by the posts in social media and calls from friends that they were going through something that they had never experienced before. So I've been here this semester, so I was here while Fiona came by.
My understanding, just for context, is that Hurricane Maria hit hard and fast all at once. Hurricane Fiona drew out the rain, made land on Sunday afternoon, and drew out the rain. Do you feel that it was the different nature of the hurricane that caused devastation in outlying areas less where you are, or was it the lack of recovery from Hurricane Maria, or both, or something else?
It's a combination of factors. Number one, the infrastructure has been battered. It was not only Maria, it was Irma 10 days before Maria. So we've been hit hard by lack of maintenance throughout the island for the electricity grid, for roads, for public structures. So one can argue that part of the reason why that Fiona has been so devastating is the fact that the infrastructure in general has been weakened. As I said before, you know, not two hurricanes are alike. And Fiona, even though had very strong winds, we had strong reports of winds up to 100 miles per hour in the highlands. We were more concerned about the water. We're talking about record levels of rain, somewhere between 30 and 40 inches of rain, which is something, you know, extremely hard. And as a result, we are seeing people that had never recovered fully since Maria, because the government and the government money has been slowly dripping over the past 5 years. So are there many public projects that were awaiting reparation and restoration, and that had not even started when Fiona came. So now we have a compounded situation, a compounded problem by all of these factors.
So we're speaking now about the Hurricane Fiona, how it passed through Puerto Rico, the devastation it did this week. Right now on the line with us from Puerto Rico, Pedro Reyna Perez, who's the director of the Harvard Puerto Rico Winter Institute. We wanted to speak with you to give us context, and I've been focusing so far in my questions with you about Hurricane Maria, which ironically the fifth anniversary was the day that the cleanup, and I laugh with irony, not joy, on Tuesday.
I'll give you another anniversary.
Yeah.
Fiona struck on the 33rd anniversary of Hurricane Hugo in 1989. for me, it was the first time my generation had ever experienced a hurricane, because Puerto Rico had not been hit by a hurricane since Betsy in 1954. So by 1989, an entire generation hadn't lived the experience of a hurricane. And it was also a very devastating hurricane, even though it only struck the northeastern part of Puerto Rico. So it was the 33rd anniversary of Hugo, and the day before, the 5th anniversary for Maria.
I can't imagine the fatigue of an island, of a community, Pedro.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Just walking around. I remember I only arrived in the island after 3 weeks after Maria had passed, and I still lived for a number of months with generators running all the time and lack of electricity everywhere. I go outside and I listen to generators and I get sort of a PTSD, and I know my friends and relatives all feel it even worse because they experienced it through the very first days after the hurricane. There's a lot of anguish in the street right now because we know a lot of people are suffering. Our faith in the government is very low. I think the government has done a very poor job of handling emergencies, because it's one thing what they say and another what people are experiencing. So there's a lack of trust in the government at this point, and also a lack of trust in the federal government, because as you already know, when Maria came by, FEMA was totally unprepared, and they had to admit before Congress that they underestimated the demands that would come after the hurricane. So right now we hear, you know, assurances from government officials, and we are right to be suspicious that a lot of the things that they're saying fall short of what needs to be done at this point.
How would you like the Massachusetts community, not only the 340,000 people roughly here who self-identify as Puerto Rican, but all of us here in the Commonwealth, to respond right now? What do you want to see? What do you need?
Fortunately, I was able to be part of the Massachusetts United for Puerto Rico Fund hosted by the Boston Foundation in 2017. And I know that there are many Puerto Ricans, not only in the greater Boston area, but also in places like Springfield, Worcester, and Holyoke. I think they should pay attention to, fortunately, this time around, communications are still in place. You can still speak to people over cellular phones. And I think our nonprofit organizations throughout the island are doing a wonderful job. And I've seen on social media a number of NGOs that are accepting donations. I think we must be ready in Massachusetts to perhaps, just as in 2017, be ready to receive a number of residents that may need to relocate. I think we're still assessing the damage. I look at the media constantly, and I am learning every hour of places that have suffered tremendous structural damage. So I don't know if we'll be able to assist them here. So I'm telling the people in the Commonwealth to be ready, these communities, to perhaps lend a hand by hosting people. But pay close attention to the nonprofit organizations that are communicating through social media what they're doing on the ground.
All right. Pedro Reina Perez is director of the Harvard Puerto Rico Winter Institute and a professor of humanities and arts and cultural agency and administration at the University of Puerto Rico. Thank you for joining us on the line today, and I wish you well.
Thank you, Tiziana. Be well.
So joining us now, Massachusetts State Senator Adam Gomez, who is the first Puerto Rican to be elected to the Massachusetts State Senate. Senator, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So where are you joining us from today, Senator?
I'm joining you from the district here in Springfield, Massachusetts. Really connecting with other local officials. I've been in communication with Boston City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo, also Worcester City Councilor Sarai Rivera, and also in communication with our partners Joshua Garcia in Holyoke. And here in Springfield, we've already been meeting with our elected leaders and NGOs, with State Representative Carlos Gonzalez and Orlando Ramos. And what we're trying to at first, the last couple of days, we've been trying to assess the situations. I know that in our municipality here in Springfield, as you've heard from the professor, we're being prepared to be able to catch our brothers and sisters that might migrate. We know that in 2017, that where the Puerto Rican communities are based, we've seen an influx of, you know, families that came over here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. At the time, I was a city councilor here at Springfield, and, you know, we did a lot of relief efforts. I think there's three big things that right now that we're looking towards is, you know, being able to, we know that the Puerto Rican people are resilient, but, you know, the traumatic experience, what we've heard from Hurricane Maria and Irma, and then now Fiona, I think that, you know, we just have to make sure that we're making sure that all the information coming from the island, we're working with also communication with some officials on the island, Puerto Rican leaders, and also I'm working... go ahead.
So thank you. So, and we're speaking with State Senator Adam Gomez here, who's in Springfield. What are you hearing from people when you speak with them on the ground in Puerto Rico?
We're hearing that, you know, bridges and also hard-to-reach places are in question. We're still waiting for the assessments to understand what are the intentional needs and the different parts of the west of the island that got hit. We are also in communication with some individuals on the island. Every day we're trying to meet with individuals to just get updates, because every on the hour, every single time, you know, we're hearing, you know, different updates on different municipalities that have been hit extremely, that are still kind of underwater.
What are you most concerned about as you're getting these updates on the hour?
The loss of life is one. You know, we want to, you know, make sure that whatever we can do from here, from the diaspora, as electeds, you know, and in communication with Governor Baker and MEMA, that, you know, we're readily available once the governor from Puerto Rico gives us the word. I know that our administration in communication with them is ready to try to send relief, and that's what we've been trying to tell folks. That one of the hardest things is to really understand what's the intentional need. There is parts of the island that, you know, that received mild, I would say, impacts, but there's extraordinary parts of the island that that are hard to get to, because bridges that were rebuilt and infrastructure that was rebuilt after Maria has been put in a position that that it's gone again. So the rebuild process is going to be an extraordinary part of it that we have to wait to see once the water subsides, what's the actual real damage.
So we have a strong Puerto Rican community, as you noted, State Senator, in Hampton County. Today, what are you hearing from families there? Is it primarily resolve, worry, frustration? What are you hearing?
It's mostly a lot of trauma. You know, 5 years to the day, people that have settled here, you know, those are, I would say, considered land bridges. So some of these individuals that already went through this traumatic experience, and now their families, again, are going through it all over again. And just making sure that we can connect with our families, you know, was one of the biggest struggles. But to say the least, it's been very tough for our community to endure this this type of catastrophe all over again.
What do you want people to know most here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts today?
We want to make sure that, you know, our community usually just jumps into action right away. We want to assess the damages, assess how we can give relief to the Puerto Rican people. Obviously, we're going to be working with our federal delegations to make sure on policy changes to try to, you know, move some policy if needed. But we already know that, you know, out of the devastation of what's going on in Puerto Rico, those are American people. We want to make sure that, you know, when it comes to the federal policies, that we can able to assist to make sure that the right need is reaching the people of Puerto Rico. And one of the issues right now that we faced in 2017 was we collected a whole bunch of goods. And did a lot of these drives, and we have transportation issues on trying to get it to certain places. And it's going to be hard in certain of these locations because of their remote locations on the island to get certain things out there. In Holyoke, they're doing a Boricua Care Package project that they use the mail, and they're receiving food. Or they're collecting food there in Holyoke and Springfield and in Chicopee. We created a group of Western Mass for Puerto Rico, just like how the Boston Foundation did. So right now, we're just opening up our welcoming centers with the New North Citizens Council here in Springfield, ready to catch our brothers and sisters to make sure that they're supported once they get here.
So appreciate you taking the time while you're working on that response. State Senator Adam Gomez of Springfield represents Hampden County. We are thinking of your work and appreciate you taking the time to be on Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, ma'am, and thank you for elevating this message. The Puerto Rican people need us, and for everyone that's listening on my Twitter, I'm releasing information on NGOs that are on the ground right now.
We have
now
to let you go, but we'll post your Twitter account. Thank you so much for joining us. Often on Wednesdays, we take some time to talk about wellness. It's a segment called Be Well, and we're going to do that today, but we're going to do it a little bit differently. Just last week, the U.S. Census Bureau released new data on child poverty.
The child poverty rate in the U.S. fell by nearly half last year to 5.2%. That is the lowest level on record and is based on a Census Bureau measure that takes into account cash benefits, tax credits, and other kinds of non-cash benefits, many of which increased during the pandemic.
Sound there from PBS NewsHour. So less poverty means more people are able to be well. But it's also something that impacts every single one of us in ways that might not be obvious at first. So we wanted to take some time to talk about the data, what it means, how it compares to where we are here in Massachusetts, and highlight how lowering the poverty level can help us collectively be well. Here with us in studio two, Kim Janey, former Boston mayor and now president and CEO of Empath, a Boston-based nonprofit that aims to disrupt poverty through direct services, advocacy, research, and a global learning network. Kim Janey, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
So do you think I framed that right? The collective impact on us of poverty when our children are poor?
Oh, absolutely. And I think framing this around wellness is also very, very important. Poverty is leading toward health disparities. People are more likely to abuse substances. So many things that are rooted in poverty. And we know that this is a policy decision, and so if we want to do something about it, we need our elected officials, we need those who are in positions to offer up new policies to do so. This news is encouraging, and what I would say about it, it affirms what we already know, which is that additional cash benefits will help children get out of poverty. And we saw with all of the resources coming from the federal government, throughout the pandemic, that it has made a difference. Now the question is, what happens now that we have stopped all of those benefits from coming? Are we going to see a sliding backwards? I worry that we will. We've got to continue to invest. We've got to make sure that we do what is working.
So a couple of things there that I want to pull apart. One is, you talked about the pandemic measures. And one of the things that happened was an expansion of the child tax credit. And there is research now to demonstrate that that expansion did lift kids who were experiencing poverty out. There has been back and forth. We've had a number of poverty advocates on the show since the beginning of that expansion arguing it works, so keep it going. Where are we in that conversation, and where is the pushback given the data?
Yeah, you know, I would say that we do need to continue to do what works. We've seen it work, so we should continue to advocate for what works. What we have seen at EMPATH, which stands for Economic Mobility Pathways, is that the cash assistance helps and that works, but we have seen a success when we couple that cash with counseling, with mobility mentoring, which is grounded in brain science, and it helps families do some long-term planning, some goal setting to help them get out of the always addressing that immediate crisis. It's crisis after crisis after crisis, and to really think long term about where they want to go with their lives. And so through mobility mentoring, it's something we've done locally as well as with our partners across the country. We have 150 members who are also using mobility mentoring, and we have seen success. And so I would advocate strongly for continued cash assistance coupled with the counseling and the mentoring that will help families move out of poverty for good.
And do you feel like we've got the infrastructure here in the Commonwealth? We have one of the highest concentrations of nonprofit organizations in the country. So Empath does great work. You can't do all the work. Do you think we've got the infrastructure here in the Commonwealth to do that for our families that are experiencing poverty?
Well, in terms of human service organizations, yes. In terms of electeds who believe in this work and who are trying to, you know, advocate for policies that will help families, I think though that's the good news in all of this. The bad news is that Massachusetts, and particularly the city of Boston, continues to be one of the most expensive places to live in the country. And so when we think about the poverty level, the federal line of poverty, we know that that is still outdated. That's outdated, and that's not capturing all of the folks who may be living above the poverty line but still can't make ends meet. So when we think about in Massachusetts, you know, the cost of living here, there have been tons of stories about the kind of income that you have to earn to be able to live in Boston or to be able to live in the Commonwealth. And we know so many families fall below that, and that there are a number of families who are above the poverty line but who still don't have the resources that they need, and are still making very difficult choices around childcare versus rent versus utility versus healthcare. Families shouldn't have to make those choices, particularly in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts or in the country that is the United States of America.
So let's bring this back to wellness. And we're speaking with former Boston Mayor Kim Janey, who is now the head of Empath. And we're talking on our Be Well segment this week about the impact of poverty on wellness, especially for children, and what we are increasingly learning works and how that relates to all of us. I want to come back to this wellness question now. One of the things, and I'm not going to cite research here, I'm going to cite what we know from our own lives. Flexibility allows us to be well. Ability to make the decisions that we need to respond to the daily challenges of our lives allow us to be well. Having some amount of housing security, food security, transportation security are all things that allow us to be well. Child poverty undermines all of those things.
Absolutely.
Because the child is in a family that's experiencing poverty. Talk now, connect more neighbor to neighbor. How does it affect our neighborhoods when other families are not able to do what they need to do to be well?
Well, then we see a concentration of poverty and all that comes from that, whether that be, you know, higher rates of illnesses. We see higher rates of asthma. We see a life expectancy gap when there's deep, deep poverty. In the neighborhood in which I live, there's 30 years, depending on which zip code, which side of the line you live on.
Difference in life expectancy.
Yes, 30 years. Yeah. 30 years. So when you have that deep concentration of poverty, it affects so many folks because you'll see, you know, more violence. You'll see poor quality of schools. You'll see all of the things that you don't want to see when we're talking about wellness and we're talking about a healthy community. And so all of us should be concerned about this. When we think about, again, the federal poverty line for a family of four is about $28,000. When I think about the last time that I made $28,000, you know, you can't.
Yes. More than 6 years ago, it cost more than $60,000 a year for a family of three to be able to survive in Boston. You're talking $28,000, and that was before the last 6 years of increases in housing.
And then just think of our rents.
Yeah.
So for a two-bedroom apartment, $4,000 or $5,000, average rent for one bedroom is going to be over $2,000. If you're only making $28,000 a year, clearly there are huge gaps there. And so this impacts all of us, and we should all care about poverty in the United States, you know, one of the richest nations in the world, and yet we have these huge divides. Unfortunately, here we also see this line up with race, and so there are lots of correlations between what race you are and whether you will have the opportunities for upward mobility, depending, again, on what race, where you were born, zip code, all of that. So we have a lot of work to do. This, the reports that have come and the census data have come, it's encouraging because it has shown when we invest, we can do something about it. So we need more investment, and we need to couple that investment with the counseling, the coaching, the mobility mentoring that works, that helps families with their long-term planning and their goal setting. We believe at Empath that families know best, that they know how to best utilize the additional cash, and with the extra support around some goal setting, that they should be the drivers of their own success. But we also know that we've got to invest in the social safety net.
So I want to talk about the two levels of angst about the cash question. At one level, we have experienced, especially since welfare reform in 1996, a political divide in the country around whether or not cash transfer payments are an appropriate way to address poverty. Lots of conversation around work versus cash. And we've seen that increase in the political divide over these last, 26 years, that is, I think. We also have in general, and I know this from having done anti-poverty work in our foundation world, a philosophy that direct money to people who are experiencing poverty is not necessarily the optimal way to go. But you're showing research now, you're talking about experience with Empath now, that says actually as a piece of the puzzle is pretty important. How do we begin to change the public conversation?
Yep. And it's not just what we say at Empath, it's what these data say right now, right in front of us.
Yeah.
The cash makes a difference. We saw what it did for child poverty. So I don't think we should be telling ourselves that it doesn't matter. It does matter. And what I'm here saying is it matters, we need more of it, and we should couple it with other things that we know works. If we care about the poverty rates, if we care about what happens when children live in poverty. And so I believe we're a nation that cares. I still hold out hope that we do care about each other, that we can get beyond the political divisions, and that we can do what is best for our children, who are the most vulnerable in our society. There is a quote from Nelson Mandela that says, if you want to understand the soul of a society, of a nation, you just look at how they treat their children. And we've got work to do.
We're talking to former Boston elected official and now president and CEO of Empath, Kim Janey. For our last couple of minutes, I want to look at statewide policy and politics for a minute here. And I'm going to play a little sound for you here from Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern, who has been calling for a national conference on hunger for the first time in 5 decades. That will now be happening next week. Actually, here is Representative McGovern appearing as part of Nutrition 2022 live online back in June, talking about what he hopes to accomplish.
We need a holistic plan to finally end hunger and improve nutrition in this country once and for all. So that's why I called upon President Biden to host a White House conference on hunger, nutrition, and health. This conference will bring together agencies from across the federal government, as well as researchers, advocates, private industry, and people with lived experiences to develop a roadmap to end hunger by 2030.
He often has said on our show that hunger is a political choice. So what do you want to see? We're heading into midterm elections. We've got several new statewide offices that will be elected. We've got a Massachusetts congressional delegation. Jim McGovern is one. What do you want to see from our elected officials in the next year, given what we've talked about poverty and wellness?
Well, I believe here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we have the resources that we need. When we think about government, whether city or state government, we think about the human service organizations and different nonprofits. We think about our EDs and our MEDs and all of the institutions, the think tanks here. We have the resources. I agree with the representative in his call to action. I think we need to do more. What I would like to see is a laser-like focus on the issues of hunger, on education, on housing, on economic mobility, issues around poverty that will get us to a place of being well. And I think we have what we need. And so I, you know, celebrate that we've got Democrats going into the final, many of whom are women, which I'm super excited about. And I think that matters because we're talking about child poverty. We've got moms who are going to be leading for the first time in many of these positions who are going to bring a new perspective and a new lens. And so I'm excited about what this means for us here in Massachusetts in terms of the midterms across the country. I am hoping that we elect folks who are willing to tackle these longstanding problems. We've been talking about a war on poverty since I was a very little girl. Here we are, 50 plus years later, and many of the same issues still exist and have gotten even worse. We have seen a bigger divide when it comes to income and who earns. We've seen a bigger divide in terms of wealth, but I am hopeful that we can do something about it.
Kim Janey, President and CEO of MPATH, talking with us about being well and addressing poverty. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chanel Chloe Villegas has been in 16 professional theater productions in Boston since 2018. On stage, she shines, and it isn't just because she's well-practiced. WBUR's Lauren Williams spoke with her about the power of being on stage.
Villegas has the ability to shapeshift into different people. She has a rare precision when she's under the bright lights. It comes from a place of empathy for herself and her character.
I go through a personal transformation when playing roles. And yeah, when I'm performing, I just feel incredibly alive and incredibly connected to myself.
As a kid, Villegas used to tell little lies to her friends to make them laugh. She was encouraged to try out theater because of how convincing she was. But when she got on stage for the first time, she realized she wasn't faking. She felt seen.
I just felt like I just came alive. Every part of myself, the best parts of myself, were being shown.
That raw emotion she projects on stage comes from a real place. Villegas struggled with disordered eating and depression in her youth, but after a summer camp at the American Repertory Theater, she discovered the art form's transformational power.
I reached a point like in the disorder where like I felt like I couldn't even laugh, like I couldn't connect with other people, and I was just not myself. But when I would go there, I would be like talking and lively. It's all because of this program that I was like, oh my God, it's like changing me from the inside out.
Villegas learned a new kind of self-compassion through theater. This is why she runs towards roles that allow her to explore the full array of human emotions, even if the characters are misunderstood or unlikable, like Lady Macbeth, one of her dream roles.
I feel like I could just show all of her other side, like her deep sadness and how her big loss of losing a child makes her so badly want to have a win.
When Villegas is on stage, she helps bring a different world to fruition, one more thoughtful and compassionate than the one we have.
And that's WBUR's Lauren Williams. Lauren's story is part of our week-long series, The Makers, highlighting local artists of color. Today on All Things Considered here on WBUR, we'll meet urban planner Anita Morrison-Matra. And you can see photos and videos of all the artists WBUR is featuring this week by visiting our website, WBUR.org.
Imagine going into a space where there's like over 300 people and you're the one. So that's just like intimidating in and out itself, and just making them understand like people have real worries about going into spaces with a lot of white people.
That's Janasia Little, spring 2022 graduate of Boston College, and it's how many young black students and young black women students feel while attending predominantly white colleges and universities. Two black professors in Massachusetts have thought about this a lot and experienced it, and it prompted them to write the book Sister Resistors, Mentoring Black Women on Campus. The book is centered on the black experience in higher education and how white women on campus can help. We're joined now by Janie Victoria Ward, professor emerita at the Departments of Education and African Studies at Simmons University, and Tracy Robinson Wood, professor of applied psychology at Northeastern University. Professor Ward, you're here in Studio 2. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for having us.
And Professor Robinson Wood on Zoom, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm so delighted to be here, Tiziana.
So, Janie, what would you like people to understand about what it's like for young people in these spaces? Does Janae's sound there, does that capture it?
It does capture it. And while Black women in college often come away from college saying, you know, I was 4 years and it was a lot of fun, and I made a lot of really good relationships, and I'm ready for my career. It's also true that an awful lot of young Black women face some challenges that their white counterparts just do not. And so my colleague Tracy and I have had many, many years of Black students coming into our offices, plopping themselves down and bursting out crying and telling us about some of the issues they face. For example, having an unusual or an unconventional name that professors just can't seem to pronounce correctly, even though they've been corrected many, many times. They are often told that they're taking the place of a more deserving white student. They are presumed to be poor. They are assumed to be incompetent. And they are supposed to know about all things racial, even though most of us do not. So those misrepresentations, those stereotypic ideas about who Black women are can really derail young Black women. And so we, Tracy and I, have been developing our theory of resistance over the years. And when we talk about resistance, it's resistance to those kinds those of things. Ideas.
So, Tracy Robinson Wood, I'm going to turn to you in a moment. I want to play a little more sound here from Janaysia Little, who, as a senior, participated in a mentorship program called RISE, provided by the Women's Center at Boston University. It pairs students with faculty members. And in full transparency, I spent some time as a professor at Boston College, and I was a faculty mentor in the RISE program when I was there. So she double majored in biology and African studies, and she often felt isolated in her science classes. Here she is, Tracy.
So it was just a struggle when sometimes I go into my lab that was like either 3 hours or 4 hours once a week, and the TA kind of has to force the students to work with you. You're the last person to get picked to be working on an assignment with, or you just go into class and, like, let's say you were sick one day, hey, can I see your notes? It's like a hesitation type of thing. It was just never inviting, even with professors. Professors would be like, oh, like half of the class is getting it. Why aren't you getting it?
And I misspoke and said Boston University, not the first person to ever do that, but we are talking about Boston College. So Tracy Robinson Wood, how do universities, I can't imagine a single university administrator listening to that and saying, that's what I want for the experience. Go ahead. Yeah.
That's exactly right. I think that we certainly can hear this young woman's deep concerns. They're very, very valid. You know, they're the same concerns that Janie and I had decades ago when we were an undergraduate. And so we really have to ask, why 40 years later do we still hear young women speaking of this sense of alienation and isolation? So we need to understand what the climate is on these campuses that help students, that transmit a message that you don't belong here, that there's something about your body that isn't read as consistent with being a STEM student or being smart or being in this particular space. And so we need to be able to help that young woman realize that you belong there and give her some tools as to how to navigate that very difficult environment, but also work with mentors to help them to hear young women speak about these climates and be able to listen well and to offer some real guidance, which we call mentoring and resistance, to help her understand the importance of her forward movement and not being derailed, if you will, by these climates that can take you down if you're not, you know, if you're not careful and you don't get the appropriate support that you need.
We're talking with Professors Tracy Robinson Wood and Janie Victoria Ward, who are co-authors of a book called Sisters Resistors. One more piece of sound from Janaysia here, Janie Victoria Ward, and I want to move into your call for mentoring and resistance specifically from white women on campus. So Janaysia talks about the mentorship she received at BC, and in particular, a professor in the biology department, Daniel Taylor, Hagen at BC, who's a white woman and one of the few white professors that she had, who spoke to the class about racially motivated incidents that happened on campus and would check in with her Black students.
She was always the one who even brought stuff up to me, like, hey, Janae, like, I heard what happened. Like, are you okay? Are your friends okay? Like, I'm here for you if you want to talk. So I feel like she was not only tapped into her students, but also just like the culture of what's going on campus. And I think that was something that was good because it's easier to, like, instead of always having to bring up something.
So she goes on, as we hear, to talk about how important that was for her. You are talking to white women on university campuses in this book, Janie.
That's right. And so in order to understand what it is that we are trying to invite white women to do, it's important to begin first by talking about resistance and what we, when we say resistance, what we're talking about. We're talking about those coming up with responses, with strategies to be able to deal with those situations in which one feels invalidated or demeaned or discounted or, you know, in some way it's communicated to you that you don't belong here. And so Black women learn how to push back against that, right? A lot of Black women come into the college campus with some ideas about pushing back, as well as they know it's important to push back. Maybe their mamas have told them that, their grandmamas, their daddies have said, you know, when you get to that predominantly white institution, you got to be careful. So some young women come in already armed, but other Black women do not. Right? There is no monolithic Black women's experience, just as there's no monolithic white women's experience. So this idea of resistance has to be respected, right? Now, for white women, a lot of white women have not had a lot of experience with resistance. It's a Black thing, it's a Black woman's thing, but for white women, it might be something that, you know, just haven't practiced in their lives.
I know there are white women out there listening, and I want to note that I'm white because we're having a conversation on race here. There will be white women listening who will say, I've resisted on the gender front.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And so what we are encouraging white women to do is to get in touch with their own histories of resistance, right? And it could be that they've had to resist around gender bias. It could be there could be other identity statuses that they have around ability, around socioeconomic status, where they have found themselves in situations where people have made assumptions about them that does not align with the way that they see themselves. So when white women are in touch with their own resistance, they are better able to work with younger Black women to figure out what's the best resistance strategy that we can create in this moment for this specific situation so that we can make certain that you get what you need to get.
So we're having a conversation about a book called Sister Resistors, which calls on especially white women in university environments to change their support for and mentor young Black women through the university experience. We were just hearing from Janie Victoria Ward there from Simmons University. Tracy Robinson Wood is also with us from Northeastern University. So Tracy, let's pick up with where Janie just left off. How does a white woman then begin to support the resistance of young Black women and be a more effective mentor?
Yes, it's a lovely question. I really appreciate Janaysha and her boldness to speak so clearly about her experience and how she named this mentor, a white woman who was very, very helpful to her. We believe that white women, who are the majority of mentors in higher education in terms of career services, financial aid, residential life, can be very mighty with regards to the effectiveness of their mentoring. But we also know that the history of racism and racial segregation can pull Black women and white women apart. And so I I think to be an effective mentor as a white woman means a facing of this long arc, if you will, of racism and the ways in which it can mean that we don't name. White women may be tentative to name racism or feel competent to be able to speak about racism. And Janaysia was speaking about her own experiences of alienation and isolation. And to be able to share that with a white mentor means that she's able to hear that and be able to even detect her own fragility or discomfort, but to be able to respond in a way that is effective so that Janaysia knows you hear me, and I can speak freely about my whole college experience with you. This is a safe place, and this is one where I don't have to mute my words or take care of you in the moment, because I can see the deer in the headlight look that you are really rather uncomfortable with what it is that I'm bringing into this conversation. So it can be a very powerful moment between the mentee and the mentor when there's this clarity as to what that young student is experiencing and how she as the mentor, they as the mentor, can be effective.
So Professor Janie Victoria Ward, one of the things that I took from the book is this is asking white women in university environments to do the work. That there may be some experience of resistance, but not racial resistance, nor is there sufficient understanding at the baseline of systemic racism, our racial history, Black literature, and you're asking white women to do the work.
We are asking white women to do the work, and we know that this is a really big ask, but we wouldn't do it if we thought that white women were totally ill-equipped to step into this role. Our experience has been that there are plenty of white women on campus who really want to make certain that every student who's on this campus receives what she needs or what he needs in order to get to that final stage of graduation. But we also realize that, you know, race creates these tensions that make life really difficult for the Black and other students of color, but also these days for white women to have the conversation, to reach out. Not only, and you know, I think it's really important for us to mention that for the white mentors, one of the things that we've discovered is that white women need support too. Right? When you're on campus and you are working with students of color and you're hearing these stories and perhaps you're going and talking to your colleagues about things that you've heard, sometimes white women find themselves in situations where, you know, folks don't want to listen to them. Yeah. Folks don't want to be colleagues with them. You're not playing the game. So white sister resistors need to have the same kind of support that young Black women need. You know, we're in this together.
And that's the last piece that I'll emphasize. We have less than a minute. So Tracy Robinson Wood, there's a mutuality to this. A being in resistance together improves the souls of both. Yes?
Beautifully said. It's a reciprocity, growing and learning from each other. You know, we encourage white women to think about what has racism taken from you? What are the losses that you have incurred because of racism?
So we are going to end there. Really appreciate this conversation. That was just Tracy Robinson Wood, professor of applied psychology at Northeastern, here in studio, Janie Victoria Ward, professor emerita in the departments of education and Africana studies at Simmons University. The book, Sister Resistors, Mentoring Black Women on Campus, which is available now on Amazon. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.